The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Ollie Mann, and this is Tech Weekly. Now, when you hear that the world is made of information, what's the image that leaps into your mind? A series of Wikipedia paragraphs, perhaps? A string of code? Well, that's because we normally think of information as a series of messages, ideas we understand about something. But a new book that's out reminds us all that information is something in and of itself. Information is physical. The book's called Why Information Grows by Cesar Hildego, a professor at the Anti-Disciplinary Media Lab at MIT. In it, he explains why new ways of computing this sort of data can change the world. Well, to get to grips with this idea, we invited The Guardian Special Projects Editor James Ball into the studio. His background is data journalism, working out how to use information to tell stories, and he quizzed Cesar on what this all could mean for tech.
Cesar, you've just written this book essentially on information, and it's not just about its potential and what it can do for us, but you talk quite deeply about how information's kind of embedded in the world and actually in our economics. So, I mean, do you want to sort of talk a bit about that? Because we don't really think of it. We think as information as stuff we tell each other, not something that's sort of concrete.
And that's right. Most people think of information as messages that communicate the state of a system. You know, so for instance, I can tell you that my car is red, and that is information about my car. But what I argue in the book, which is something that is known in the realm of physics, is that information actually is physical, and it's not only involved in messages, but it's also involved in objects. So for instance, if I take my car and I crash it against a wall, that car loses its value because the way in which the atoms that make the car are ordered was changed. And that is a change in information. So you can think of information as physical order. Sometimes you use this physical order to embody messages that used to communicate the state of a system. Sometimes you use that physical order to create objects that have practical uses. And information is the order that underlies all of these forms of communication or augmentation.
So it's the structure, it's the information that makes the difference between a Bugatti Veyron worth $2 million and kind of a bunch of scrap worth almost nothing.
Well, it's not only that. Obviously, there are other aspects, you know, that involve, you know, like how people value things. But information is a big, you know, part of it. And that's why, you know, the car would lose its value if you reshape it, you know, in as a car crash does.
Yeah. And so you jump quite sort of swiftly from this idea of information in the physical world, you know, in water, in DNA, in all sorts, to kind of what it means for us as societies and in economics. And, you know, do you want to kind of try and introduce that?
Absolutely. So if you think about it, 100,000 years ago, our planet had the same atoms that we have today. The only thing that has changed, you know, with mankind and with the explosive growth of our civilization is the way in which we have ordered the world. So we can think that our world actually is made of information. Our cars are made of information. Our shoes are made of information. Our homes, our cities, they're all made of information. And that has been possible because we have developed different ways of computing, which are different ways of arranging the world to produce objects that augment us and that allow us to do everly more interesting things.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So you start to discuss what that means in terms of, say, economics and why some economies have this huge information potential and succeed and why others don't. And what's kind of the short version of that? How do you explain that idea?
So if you understand that the world is made of information, and it is, you know, then you can understand differences between economies as differences in their computational capacity. So some economies are like an Atari 2600, and other economies are like a super cluster, you know, like the ones that are used by Google or Facebook. You know, so these economies that are like an Atari 2600, they can produce relatively few simple things, and therefore they can generate low levels of income. The other ones that are like these super mega clusters, they can produce a large diversity of things that are very hard to make and that require a lot of computing power. And therefore, they achieve high levels of prosperity. So what I do in the book is I try to explain what are the mechanisms that constrain the ability of a social and economic system to accumulate computational capacity. And they show that differences in computational capacity translate over the long run on differences on the mix of products that countries make and the income they can achieve.
So how do you go from an Atari economy to a supercomputer economy?
Well, it's a very slow process, you know, because what makes the growth of information difficult is the growth of computation. You know, to make more complex products, you need to be able to compute things. But computation is difficult because computation is based on units that have a finite capacity. So think of a biological cell. A biological cell is a computer that has a finite capacity and can only transcend that finite capacity by developing multicellularity, like the one you find in a human.
Yeah.
Humans are also finite in their capacity to process information. And therefore, we can transcend our limitations by creating social and economic structures that allow us to create networks of people that accumulate that computation. Now, generating that networks is difficult, even though it is necessary to be able to make complex things. It is difficult because, for instance, you know, our ability to generate those networks depends on the social institutions that we have. In a society that people have no trust in one another, links are very expensive because people basically distrust one another, so they're hesitant when they're interacting with other people. And people, therefore, can have few links, and they can form very small networks that have limited computational capacities. In a society that people have a lot of trust, or that they have also, let's say, technologies that enable that communication and transportation and so forth, and people can eventually form large networks, those large networks can accumulate vast amounts of computation and can produce complex things. So in some ways, social structure then translates into differences in productive structure, and that translates into difference in economic prosperity.
And sort of to jump it to a very kind of practical level, you know, in your work at MIT and elsewhere, you've kind of actually tried to sort of use tools and use visuals to sort of turn bits of data into these kind of informations and to help build these networks, haven't you? Things like Dataviva in Brazil using really detailed economics data, that kind of project. So, you know, what is technology's potential to sort of help these kind of networks build and to, you know, help economics?
Yeah. So nowadays we live in a world in which we have a lot of information about information. What I mean by that is that we have information or messages about the state of the world, you know, and that information is captured mainly for operational purposes. Like mobile phone carriers capture that information because they have to charge you a bill and they have to know who you call and for how long and, you know, when that happened. You know, governments also collect information about the state of the world through taxes and other, you know, forms of payment that are operational and that leave a digital footprint. The problem is that all of those large volumes of information is trapped in databases that are very obscure. So you have terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data that are very obscure. And what we have been doing is developing a technology that's kind of like the opposite of that, which is a stack of software that you sit on top of a database and now has certain knobs that allows you to zoom into any part of that database, and the response is not going to be just like a table or, you know, like a little bit of data, but a visualization that helps you make sense of it and a profile that makes you make sense of a lot of different things that you can know about the same entity or the same place or the same location or the same industry. So in Dataviva, we created a data visualization engine that makes available 1 billion visualizations, that's a billion with a B, for the entire formal sector of the Brazilian economy. And it's the largest effort to visualize public data that has been created to date.
And so if the idea is, you know, networks let us know more than we can as people, there's only so much I can know, there's only so much you can know. If we try and drop down the complexity of the information, it means we don't need as complex a network?
So, certainly, doing things in a social context is difficult. Everybody that has worked with other people has had frictions with other people. You know, those two things tend to come together. So, obviously, most people would strive to create things in a relatively small group if they can accumulate the computational capacity that they need in that relatively small group. What we do with our tools, in some sense, is to facilitate some computational tasks, you know, that are otherwise hard to do without representing information in a visual form. So, for instance, Imagine that I give you like a big table of numbers and I ask you to sort them, or I ask you to like compare them and, you know, or do some of these basic computational operations. And then I give you a bunch of like bars or a bunch of sticks. That operation becomes much easier if I'm encoding that information in a way that is graphical than in a way that is numeric. So when you're doing visualization, what you're doing is presenting people the same data, but you're presenting in such a way that they can perform these complex mathematical operations with this visual channel that is very effective. And therefore, you know, they can start extracting patterns, developing hypotheses, and exploring the system that this data is about much more effectively.
And so sort of on Data Viva and the other sort of similar projects that you've done, has anyone managed to come back yet and sort of tell you, oh, hey, we managed to do this because of that, or we learned this?
Yeah. Absolutely. So some of those stories actually involve myself. So let me tell you a story in which we created a project called Pantheon that looks at cultural production data. Okay? So we had done a lot of work before looking at the mix of products that countries make and the industries that are present in a location. And at some point I realized that I was missing, you know, Elvis Presley, Miles Davis, Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, you name it. I was missing cultural production. So for a couple of years, we developed, you know, an effort to compile a data set. And honest to God, when we were compiling that data set, I thought that what we were going to be able to understand were differences between the diversity and ubiquity of the cultural products that are produced in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
And those results were there, they were conspicuous. But what I realized is that by collecting this data on cultural production, which looked at 6,000 years of history, I could answer questions of collective memory that I had not asked before. You know, and I started actually to develop my research agenda now around these ideas of collective memory to try to understand how technology affects how much we remember and what are the topics that we remember, you know, and there are very strong effects that I'm starting to uncover that basically came from developing a resource that was visual and then that resource in some way telling me that there were more interesting questions than the ones that I developed the resource for.
And so what was the most sort of surprising thing you learned from Pantheon then?
So there's two things regarding collective memory. The first one is that the rate at which we record historical information is constant for periods of constant technological, as technology does not change. So for instance, you know, if you look at the rate at which we produce globally famous individuals, you know, before the printing press, you know, that number is constant for 2,000 years. And when the printing press comes along, you look at the rate at which we produce globally famous individuals more or less doubles and goes constant again. So there are these discontinuities in our ability to record information. If we go before the printing press and before writing, that rate basically was zero because nobody can tell you the name of someone that was born 40,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. We also find that there are strong discontinuities in the types of cultural information that we record. So before the printing press, most of the cultural information that was recorded were about political figures and religious figures. After the printing press, the sciences and arts start to grow, and there are painters and composers that become globally famous, and physicists and chemists and mathematicians and astronomers. Then film and radio come, and when film and radio, you know, become popular, the arts flip completely. And now it is not the playwright that becomes famous, but the actor, the musician, the singer. It becomes somehow like a performing arts. Why? Because, well, now the medium is encoding information about the performance. Before, the medium was the paper that was encoding information about the structure of the play and, you know, the dialogues and so forth. So we also find a strong effects on how the communication technologies that we develop change, you know, how much we remember and what we remember.
That's really interesting. And I'm sure you have come across this idea of digital decay, that, you know, paper lasts for hundreds of years. You know, we've got stone tablets from Egyptian times that lasted thousands of years. Digital information doesn't last very long. And so, you know, you're talking about we're getting new ways of being famous and new rates of being famous. Are we at risk of, are the ways that we encode information now got that risk of being really temporary? You know, do we have a risk of consequences because of that?
So information, in order to survive, it doesn't survive because it was embodied on one sort of physical device that lasted very long. Information survives as long as it reproduces. Okay, so in some way, you know, we're still talking about Isaac Newton, not because people have like the first manuscript of the Principia in their hands, but because that information keeps on being, you know, recombined and reproduced and translated and mixed with other content in such a way that it survives. So it's kind of like a bit of like a ghost, you know, but a more, you know, maybe metaphorical, but in some sense, more scientific type of ghost that is made of information that spreads around the world, and that what guarantees it conservation. So a hard drive maybe doesn't last too long, maybe a few decades, you know, if it's relatively good. But the information that is in it, like the soul that is stored in that flesh, you know, gets to reproduce and therefore gets preserved that way.
When you want the whole picture, you choose The Guardian. When you want to create your own, you choose Squarespace, the all-in-one website building platform that lets you buy domains, create your own logo, and more. Whatever you want to showcase, Squarespace gives you simple yet powerful tools and elegant designs to make any idea brilliant. Create your own picture at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
One of the sort of things I liked about the book was this sense, you know, that we touched on earlier of information being a physical thing. It's not just here is the thing and here is the information about it. Do you think that insight that they're kind of often the same thing, does that let you do something, or does that move you forwards, or is it just an interesting thing to know?
Well, you know, it is on the one hand like a fundamental property of nature. So if you talk with quantum computing guys like Seth Lloyd at MIT, or his advisor who watches this Landauer guy that wrote a bunch of papers titled Information is Physical, you would realize that like our natural sciences during the 60s, 70s, and 80s and 90s went through a transformation in which people realized that when two particles interact, you know, they're not just exchanging velocities and position. What essentially they're changing is actually information. Yep. You know? And that computation is this fundamental thing. What I'm trying to do with the book is a little bit like bring some of those ideas now to the social science and to the economic sciences, which can also be understood in terms of information and computation. So I do think that is a fundamental way of understanding nature that helps us make bridges between the social sciences and the natural sciences. And those bridges have been traditionally not been very easy to build.
And if I had to sort of push you on the biggest gap, where's the most potential? Where are we kind of worst at this? You know, where's this got the sort of most ability to help?
I think we're very primitive at the moment in our understanding of how organizations compute. Here, The Guardian, you know, is an organization with a large number of people, which I'm sure you don't know all of them. You know, and you guys collectively compute a number of different, you know, digital and printed resources, you know, that are the products that you make. And the process by which that happens, you know, is a process that I think we're beginning to understand, but relatively poorly, because we don't have like detailed data of the interactions that people have inside organizations and how these organizations interact with other organizations. And there's a whole science now that is trying to look at these forms of like social computing or, you know, organizational memory, which are questions that also were explored by Herbert Simon, but also at a time that there was not too much data that you could use to actually see how, you know, organizations are wired and how that wiring evolves and how that wiring affects their ability to make things. So that's, for instance, a place where I think there is going to be like a fertile avenue for new research, understand how computation happens at the collective level.
So I just sort of pushing from that, you know, is there... The processing sort of relies on data, and you know, you're saying we've got way more of it, but especially in economics, a lot of it's wrong. You know, we can't even get the last quarter's GDP for US right a lot of the time. It gets adjusted hugely. If we don't get really big, sort of easy numbers like that right, how can we get these little bits, especially sort of in these smaller economies that are the Ataris of the world? How do we actually sort of push that properly?
No, I think actually like sometimes those big numbers, you know, that have a lot of like resonance and that put a lot of political pressure on the system might be harder to get than a lot of like the little numbers that are sometimes collected for operational purposes. So if you think about it, most organizations that provide email to their employees have actually like a very detailed record of one form of social interaction that occurs and that helps coordinate activities. Most of them would never dare to touch them because of privacy concerns, you know? Yeah. But that doesn't mean that information is not there and cannot be mined. In fact, like in 2013, we launched this project called Immersion, that is a visualization site in which you log in with your email and it inverts your email by, you know, instead of showing it to you as a list of messages, it shows to you as a network in which the people that you interact with are the nodes and the people that have been in the same messages are connected. And it provides you like that view of your social capital that in some sense, if you do it with your own email, is very refreshing. And you can think that just like we did immersion at the personal level, we could very easily make something like immersion for an organization, you know? And the main barrier to do that nowadays is not technology and it's not the lack of data, but it's actually the political will and coordination that you would need to do that. And what I find that even if you talk to someone that is very much at the top of an organization, they wouldn't even know where to start, you know, because these are things that they're not part of standard procedures, you know?
And I mean, on those sorts of projects, you know, you talk about immersion where you can build it for yourself. Yeah. And a lot of what people worry about is, you know, the NSA or GCHQ building those networks for them. And of course, we know they do that. Is there a limit to how much information we should know? I mean, how do you do the trade-off between the potential in getting better at processing information and collecting it and maybe the risks?
Yeah. So, and privacy is a question that I've noticed now that I've been in the UK for like a little bit more than a week that I get very often. It's something that is on everyone's mind, it looks like. And like there's some standard techniques that you can use to in some way navigate that trade-off, which are techniques that are based on aggregation. So for instance, when the GDP number comes out, you don't feel violated, don't you? You know, even though you technically contribute to that number. And if they would say, what is the GDP of London? You wouldn't feel technically violated either, you know, because in some sense, you are averaged out over a large number of people. So when you have a lot of information, you can still achieve a relatively high level of granularity that allows you to understand systems at high resolution, but that preserve anonymity. You know, so when you're looking at information, you need to understand, you know, what is the granularity at which you can look at if this is information that is sensitive, you know, and therefore you can actually feed it back to the people publicly, you know, if it's done at the right granularity. In the case of DataViva, originally we have data that is at the individual level that includes, you know, the employment history and salaries of people. That's information that for many people would be considered sensitive. But when I use it to create a profile for the municipality of São Paulo or the municipality of Belo Horizonte and about their industrial composition and its evolution, obviously that type of information is something that we can deliver back to the people. It's not sensitive, it's useful, and it's in an aggregation that does not violate privacy.
Thank you. And just a final one for you. We often hear about this idea of drowning in data. We collect so much and so much records itself automatically, electronic transfers, emails, all of the things that you talk about. Do you think that, are you an optimist or a pessimist? Is our ability to understand everything we collect in keeping pace with our ability to pick it up?
Well, we always struggle, but we always manage. So in some way, you can think that like big data revolution might have started like 150 years ago here in the UK, where guys like William Farr, you know, started to do the records in which they had information about every person that died and what their family members were, so they could assign, you know, their inheritance to, you know, their family. And William Farr, for instance, was one of the first people to figure out from that large data set, you know, that there are differences in the mortality of different occupations and that, for example, people that are married tend to live longer than those that are single, you know? So, like, the big data revolution has been going for a long time. It's always hard to come up with a good story once you have, like, a sea of data. But what I say is that, well, sometimes you only need just one good story because Darwin made a trip around the world and he got one good story, but it was a heck of a story.
So, Cesar, thank you very much. And Cesar Hidalgo's book, Why Information Grows, The Evolution of Order from Atoms to Economics, is out now.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.